Hello and welcome to part 4 of Midland National's quarterly audio series on Characteristics of Greatness. This is Jerry Blair, the Chief Distribution Officer at Midland National Life Insurance Company. It's a goal of ours to make sure that you know you aren't just a member of the Champions Club, you are part of a Midland National family that cares about you as well as your personal and professional development. To prove it to you, we've enlisted the help of 8-time New York Times best-selling author and acclaimed speaker Don Yeager. Through exclusive conversations with some of the greatest athletes and sports minds of all time, Don has identified 16 characteristics that help take a person from good to great. I'm excited to have him share with you some of these amazing stories that are sure to inspire, enrich, alter, or in some cases provide clarity in your life. As a benefit to you, please know that the lessons provided in this audio CD have enriched the quality of work in both individual and team environments. It has also unlocked the keys to success for companies worldwide. I'm confident it can have the same impact for you. Thank you again for taking the time to incorporate this into your listening library. Now I'd like to officially introduce my friend, Don Yeager. But to do so properly, I get to have a little help from great winners like Shaquille O'Neal, Landon Donovan, Michael Orr, Tony Siragusa, Bob Costas, Dick Vitale, and the late, great John Wooden. It's quite the introduction. Let's see if you can pick out the various voices.
Real treat today.
Your speaker today, Don Yeager, is known in the sports world
as one of the most respected and nationally acclaimed writers in our country.
Don Yeager is the author of more than a dozen books,
including 8 New York Times bestsellers.
Don's books, including the one he wrote with me, have sold more than 2 million copies and have been translated into more than a dozen languages.
Don began his career at a newspaper in Texas
and rose to become associate editor of Sports Illustrated magazine, and that's how I met him.
Hey, few people can really experience the kind of exciting resume that Don has had. He's a PTP-er, baby.
In his 25 years as a journalist, Don has worked with some of the greatest champions of our time. Michael Jordan, Mia Hamm, Serena Williams, and me.
He's been a guest on just about every major national television show, from Nightline to Good Morning America to Oprah.
This is Don Yeager, who did that that article I was telling you about that's in Sports Illustrated on newsstands now. You should really get it if you're a parent who has a child who's in sports.
He lived with my father, Walter Payton, writing his autobiography while Dad courageously battled cancer.
He even met with the President of the United States in the Oval Office.
Using lessons learned from the world of sports,
Don shares the formulas he's seen in the great winners he's worked with.
And explains how that formula can work for each of us.
As I said, you're in for a real treat.
He's awesome, baby, with a capital A.
Now please welcome my friend.
My friend.
My friend.
Now please welcome my friend, Don Yeager.
Hello again, friends, and thank you for adding this fourth piece of the Midland National Champions Club audio series into your listening library. What makes the great ones great has been a career-long study of mine, examining high-performing individuals who publicly exemplify consistent characteristics of greatness. The great winners in the sports and business worlds all have showcased the ability to excel in their respective professions and garner the awards and accolades that come with success. But it's important to know that this study of greatness wasn't limited to just the individuals who crossed the finish line first. Sometimes the qualifiers for greatness are more closely linked to the manner in which you crossed the finish line and the path you took to get there. I've identified that not every great winner, not every great leader presses forward for the trophy, fame, or fortune. Instead, their battles are won when no one is watching. Characteristic of greatness number 14, when no one is watching. The year was 2008. My computer beeped with a new email notification, and like most journalists, I quickly swiveled around in front of the screen to read the subject line. It could have been anything. This was a year full of headlines, ranging from the Boston Celtics winning the NBA championship to Michael Phelps winning a record-breaking 8 Olympic medals in Beijing, to the presidential campaign. but it was not a solicitation for my vote. Instead, the subject line read, "Do not delete this email until you watch the video." Have you ever gotten one of those emails with a subject line like that? What do you typically do? You press delete, right? Usually, that's the first thing I do. But this time, rather than send it to my spam folder, I gave it a chance. And boy, am I glad I opened that email. I actually scrolled down and noticed that right below the video link was a preview of an article that was being run in that upcoming week's issue of Sports Illustrated by a colleague of mine named Rick Riley. The opening line in Rick Riley's column was, "This is the greatest father-son love story of all time." Wow. Okay, I was a new dad, so that was enough bait for me. There's no way I was hitting the delete key after that. I went on to read the column and I was hooked. I even clicked on the video. When I did, I quickly realized I was not the first person to watch this video. It, at the time, had already had 38 million views. 38 million people. It's safe to say that this was an internet sensation. The video was of a man named Dick Hoyt, and his story absolutely captivated me. 53 years ago, Dick became a father for the first time. But as his son Rick was coming through the birth canal, the umbilical cord wrapped around his throat, and for 5 minutes, he was deprived of oxygen. When Rick was delivered, the doctors handed Dick his son and said, "Sir, given the challenges during this birth, your son will never be able to communicate. He will never be able to do anything. He is essentially brain damaged. It would be my advice to you that you leave him here with us and let us treat him because we will have better facilities than you will ever have at home." Dick Hoyt looked the doctor in the eye and said, "No way. I've waited my lifetime to be a father. I'm taking him home." Dick took his son Rick home to face the challenge of raising a spastic quadriplegic, a young boy with no feeling in his arms or legs. Dick and his wife went on to have 2 more children. Both were boys, and they all adored each other. Together, his 3 sons could regularly be seen playing that sport that was such a big deal in Boston, street hockey. Rick seemed to love hockey, and his brothers made him all-time goalie when they played. They put him in his wheelchair, moved him in front of the hockey goal, and he stayed there, taking it all in. In order to score, you had to come around Rick. You had to get past Rick. Those good times helped the Hoyt family endure the tough times, and their family went through an awful lot of struggles. But Dick refused to concede. When Rick was around 10 years old, Dick couldn't shake the feeling that something was happening with his son. He felt there was something about his son that didn't seem to fit the doctor's prognosis. So he took his son to Tufts University and asked for a meeting with a number of researchers. While they were all in a room, he said, "Trust me, I can tell there is something in my son's head. He is thinking about something. He has words there. There is something happening there, and we have to get those words out." The doctors looked at Dick Hoyt and said, "You're just a hopeful father. Look at his medical charts. There's no way that given what he went through, there's no way this young man has anything going on between his ears." They actually told Dick, "I'm sorry, this was nice of you to try," but he interrupted and said, "Before I leave, I'm going to ask you to do one thing. I'm going to step outside the hall and I want you to tell my son a joke." The doctors kept their stance but were willing to entertain Dick's request. A couple of minutes later, those same doctors came out in the hallway. They grabbed Dick Hoyt and they said, "Oh my gosh, he laughed. He got the joke." Dick Hoyt looked at those doctors, who were all still amazed by what they had just witnessed, and he said, "Well, what are we going to do now?" The doctors did more tests, and they figured out that the only control Rick Hoyt had over any muscle in his body was that of a right tilt of his head. He could move it ever so slightly, but enough to notice. It was also with enough force to make a slight impression. So with that knowledge, they built a machine for Rick. The machine weighed 100 pounds. Rick actually weighed less than that, but the machine would sit on the back of Rick's wheelchair, and it would scroll through the alphabet, and whenever it came to a desired letter, Rick could tap it with a slight tick of his head, By doing that, he could spell out words. And from those words, he could write out sentences. Using that machine, Rick was able to enroll in a school in Massachusetts. His father and mother actually went out and changed the law to allow children like him to get enrolled in public school. Rick went on, not just to graduate from high school, but also from college. It's a good tear-jerking story if it ended there. But this is a study of greatness, so there's so much more to tell. Let's go back to that first day they brought Rick home with the new machine strapped to the back of his wheelchair. Dick Hoyt and his wife were so excited. They were curious what his first words were going to be. What words did Rick want to share with them? Was he going to write, "Thank you, Dad"? Was he going to write, "I love you, Mom"? They sat there as Rick used the tap of his head against an elaborate machine to type out, "Go Bruins." As I mentioned earlier, Rick was a hockey fan. The Boston Bruins were in the NHL finals that year. Rick knew because he had been sitting silently with his dad every night and actually watching and processing the games. I can only imagine how many times he sat there wanting to say, "Go Bruins," while the two sat in front of the TV. The story takes another huge step when Rick was in high school. He attended a local basketball game on a night when the school interrupted the game and made a sad announcement. A young man from a nearby community had been injured in a bad accident, and that particular community was going to hold a rally the following Saturday. They were going to run a 5-mile race to try to raise money and increase the quality of health care offered to that injured young man. There were flyers distributed, and that night Rick Hoyt came home from the basketball game with a flyer on his lap. He typed out to his father, "We need to run in this race, because we need him to know that being paralyzed is not the end of your life." Dick Hoyt hadn't run in years. He had only one pair of tennis shoes, and they were basketball shoes. But that next Saturday, Dick went out. He strapped on what shoes he had, and he put his son in a makeshift wheelchair. Together, they ran 5 miles in the race. They finished second to last. Dick Hoyt is pretty proud of that moment, actually, because that means someone was slower than them. But after this particular race, when they returned home and Dick was sprawled out on the floor with soreness creeping throughout, Dick said he had muscles hurting him that he didn't even know he had. It's at that point that Rick began to slowly tap his head against the machine and type out something he needed to say. Rick's sentence read, "Dad, as we were running, it felt like my paralysis was gone." Dick knew immediately what he had to do. He went out and bought a new pair of running shoes. He figured out how to build a wheelchair for his son that allowed them to start running and competing in races. That next Saturday, they registered for another race. And the next weekend, they enrolled in one on Saturday and one on Sunday. And over the course of the last 35 years, this father and son team has run in more than 1,400 races. Remember I told you that Rick had no control over any muscle in his body except the slight tick of his head? But every time they finished the race, as they passed, cameras taking snapshots of them crossing the finish line, Rick raises his arm. No doctor can explain it. No father needs to. Dick Hoyt got the greatest love he could ever get by giving to his son. The duo started running these races, and it became a weekly ritual. Each Saturday and Sunday, they would load up, they'd map out their travel plans, and they'd take on whatever race they could find. His best run in a marathon puts Dick Hoyt within 30 minutes of the world record for his age group. Many people have often said to him, "Dick, imagine what you could accomplish if you weren't pushing a 110-pound boy in a 40-pound wheelchair. Imagine what you would be able to do if you went out and ran that race by yourself." And each time, Dick would say to them, "Not going to happen. I'm his arms and legs. He's my heart and soul." Quite a few years later, Rick actually typed out a note to Dick that read, "Dad, this running in races is getting kind of boring." That's funny to say to a man that's been doing the heavy lifting, right? Well, the rest of the note said, "We should try a triathlon." Now that's an even funnier joke when you learn that Rick knew his father did not know how to swim. But Dick was undaunted. He went out and found a little cabin on a lake. It's there that he taught himself how to swim. And today, they've competed in several dozen triathlons, including the Ironman competition of extreme endurance with swimming, biking, and running. Dick became a national TV sensation. He was on every major show you could imagine. Billboards in New York's Times Square showed he and his son. All throughout the Atlanta airport, ad boards featured the two of them running, one behind the other. Amazing. As I look at all of this, I was blown away. For the first 30-plus years of the two of them running races, no one knew who they were. I found it amazing that now everyone knew who they were. In fact, so powerful was their story, so inspired by their dynamic, I reached out to them. We actually did a book together in 2010 that came out on Father's Day, a book about a father's love for his son. It was during the writing of this book, which has gone on to be translated in 8 different languages, that I had the chance to interview Rick, to sit down next to his wheelchair and spend time asking him questions. It takes him a while, but he understood every question, and he'll type an answer for each one. I always look for that key question that might really inspire a great answer. The response from Rick that stands out in this study of greatness was this one. My question? Rick, if God gives you the use of your arms and legs for one day, what would you do? His answer was pretty short, but absolutely perfect. He wrote, I'd sit my father down in a chair, and I'd push him. Dick and Rick Hoyt are amazing. What an incredible duo. But one of the most fascinating things about Dick Hoyt to me is that this is a man that has never won a race. He's never finished first in any race he's ever run. Yet I will tell you that he's one of the greatest champions I've ever had a chance to be around. See, Dick Hoyt embodies what I will tell you is an absolute. You want to look at the characteristics of the truly great? You want to look at the answers these amazing champions have given to that question of what makes the great ones great? What allows you to go from good to great? Dick Hoyt's answer is that he didn't do it to get famous. He didn't do it to get rich. He didn't do it to have people know who he was. The YouTube craze that created his sensation wasn't his concern. Heck, he barely even knew about email, let alone what YouTube was. Dick Hoyt did what he did because it was the right thing to do. He did it because he lives his life comfortably with integrity. It's a good story for everyone to know, but Dick Hoyt is a greater story because of what he did consistently when no one knew. That's characteristic of greatness number 14, when no one is watching. We've all been blessed at some point over our lifetime to experience some amazing things and accomplish some amazing goals. But this study of greatness has really been a true blessing to me. Sure, it's allowed me to find avenues of success and build quality relationships with some of the greatest athletes and leaders of all time, but it's most importantly helped define my own character, my own high performance, my own leadership. It's my hope for you that this discussion of what makes the great ones great truly becomes of great value to you. Greatness is available to all of us. It is if you're willing to do common things uncommonly well. Greatness is about mental, emotional, and spiritual discipline. The great winners have all made it quite clear. They want to be part of a great team. They seek their own greatness, and they want to be part of something bigger than themselves. And greatness also requires proper nutrition. The great ones know each day is an opportunity to get another step closer to greatness. What you put into your mind and body can fuel your greatness. Thank you for adding this to your listening library. As always, I challenge you to go out, be great every day. It's my pleasure to end session 4 in this audio series for the Midland National Champions Club with the story of a friend of mine whose life journey is an absolute in the study of what makes the great ones great. Of the 16 lessons gleaned from the greatest winners and leaders in the world of sports and business, this particular lesson emphasizes the ability to defy human nature. Complacency is one of the biggest ways to sabotage success. Self-satisfaction is a huge pitfall to sustaining consistent success. The truly great ones adopt a mentality that sees beyond the finish line and focuses on their next race. They know the next goal awaits, and there's always a next goal. Characteristic number 6. What off-season? Being a huge sports guy with a sports writing background, I've always gravitated toward larger-than-life athletes with larger-than-life stories. Several years ago, there was a movie called The Blind Side that was right in my wheelhouse. It was a box office hit. I saw it several times in the theater and was so attracted to it that I later bought it for my own collection. Great movie. My favorite scene involved a woman, played by Academy Award-winning actress Sandra Bullock, who had just made her husband pull the car over to the side of the road so that she could get out and talk to a young man she recognized trudging through a cold, rainy evening. The movie scene sounded like this.
Big Mike. Hey, my name's Leanne Toohey. My kids go to Wingate. You said you were going to the gym? School gym's closed. Why were you going to the gym? Big Mike, why were you going to the gym?
Because it's warm.
Do you have any place to stay tonight? Don't you dare lie to me.
Seen that look many times. She's about to get her way.
Come on. Come on. SJ, make room. Get inside. Come on.
Where are we going?
Home.
For those of you who didn't actually see the movie, I'll provide some context for you. The story is about a young man affectionately referred to as Big Mike. Big Mike's real name was Michael Orr. He was a sophomore in high school. Michael's size alone meant that he had some athletic gifts, gifts that actually allowed him to be invited to come in and be part of a private school environment. But Michael was also one of 13 children born to a drug-addicted mother. His situation was bad. So bad, his family often had trouble staying in the same house for more than a few years. They were constantly moving from house to house. When Michael was invited to attend private school, his family had been living in a rough area near Memphis, Tennessee, in a housing project called Hurt Village. How do you call a housing project Hurt Village? I mean, I understand it was named after a city councilman whose last name was Hurt, but couldn't they have thought about picking a different city council person? Pick somebody else, not named Hurt. Anyway, Michael lived in Hurt Village, and as you learn more about his childhood, you find often that he would show up at his house, and the house would be locked, and his mother was gone. She'd be gone for days. It was truly a bad situation for any kid to grow up in. It had all the ingredients for failure, but the end result was remarkable. In spite of the adversity, Michael accepts the invitation and attends Briarcrest Christian School, the small private school referenced earlier. While attending this private school, this small, wealthy family becomes enamored by the gentle giant. The family takes him in, ultimately adopting him, and before long, Michael Orr had become a pretty substantial part of the community at Briarcrest Christian School. He was 6'5", 310 pounds, and very athletic. Naturally, he became a staple of the athletic community as well. Because of Michael, people started paying attention to the school, a school that had never been known for producing top Division I college talent. He actually started getting offers from colleges and universities. Coaches and scouts from different programs wanted him to come there to play football for their college teams. Michael Orr chose Ole Miss. Let's focus on that for a moment. A young man who had no academic history because of his rough upbringing was now getting a full-ride scholarship to play football in the Southeastern Conference. The story became even more remarkable when he ultimately was awarded all-conference academic honors. It wasn't enough for him to find satisfaction in leaving Hurt Village for Briarcrest Christian School. It wasn't enough for him to excel in football on the high school level. He wanted to dominate on the college football field. Then it wasn't enough for him to rest on his football talents. He sharpened his saw by attacking his education with the same commitment he gave to football. There was consistently another goal in his mind that constantly pushed him to do more and to be more. Big Mike reached his next goal in 2009 when he finished up his final collegiate season at Ole Miss and became a first-round draft pick of the Baltimore Ravens. As many of you might remember, by the time he took to the NFL draft stage, people knew his story. It was dubbed Homeless to the NFL. It was a pretty powerful lesson. The Blind Side movie hit theaters not long after that, and Michael had definitely gained some national fame and notoriety. But it may surprise you, because of the success of the movie, to learn that Michael Orr had nothing to do with the movie. He wasn't involved in the making of the film, or even telling the filmmakers and producers various details of his life. In fact, to see the movie The Blind Side, Michael Orr paid $9.50 to sit in the back of the theater. He bought his own popcorn. He sat in the back of the theater and watched the movie about his own life. Imagine that. He's the real deal, sitting in the back row, while everyone else is glued to the screen. Michael was later given a chance to tell his own story in a book, and he asked me to be the writer of that book. We worked on it for the better part of a year. I Beat the Odds was the title of the book, but what fascinated me about Michael is what I will tell you is an absolute of what makes the great ones great. Here you have Michael Orr, a man whose story had already been chronicled to the point where people knew every little bit about him and what he was going through. But he wasn't focused on the success and recognition. Instead, for Big Mike, it was about what he intended to do from that point forward. He signed his professional football contract coming out of Ole Miss, and he got $17 million in guaranteed money. Coming from Hurt Village, he never thought he'd get $17 million just for writing his name on a document. But suddenly, he was in this place of wealth and happiness. We see a lot of people in sports sign a lucrative contract, get the big deal, get money that they never thought they'd have, and they blow it all at every wild and expensive party they can attend. They show up at every club that's open, and before long, they've partied themselves out of the league and out of money. Not Michael Orr. While working with him, I actually spent much of a summer in Oxford, Mississippi. That's the town where Ole Miss is located. That's also where Big Mike lived in the off-season. But for Michael Orr, there was no off-season. You see, just in case a player wants to keep up to the same level of training during the months he's away from his NFL team, many of the pro teams will send an off-season workout regimen to the athletic department of the big college in the town where their pro athlete resides. It's not mandatory, but it does heighten the chances that the players come back to the team in good shape when the summer is over. So as I mentioned, I visited Michael Orr at Ole Miss in the peak of the summer. If you've ever been to Mississippi in July, you'll know it's pretty hot there. I'm just guessing, but the temperature might be just short of hell there, but I could be wrong. It was crazy how hot it was each and every day, and yet what amazed me was that I ended up in a conversation with the man who assisted the workouts for Michael Orr and 11 other NFL prospects who picked Oxford as their summer training ground. He told me that each player was responsible for working out on a daily basis and trying to be in good shape, but in the years he's been assisting with those workouts, he's never had a player like Michael Orr. You see, Michael Orr never missed a day. He does not miss a day of working out, even as a 300-pound multimillionaire in that brutal Mississippi sun. And one day, during the workouts, I asked Michael, "That's crazy. You're wealthy now beyond all imagination, and if you stopped today and lived on what you have currently, you'd still never have to work another day in your life. Yet every day, in this oppressive heat, you're out there doing what others won't do. Why is that?" Michael Orr said, "You know what? I learned a long time ago that the day I stop is the day somebody else is catching up." Now here's a nugget of wisdom from a guy who hails from one of the worst educational environments you can imagine. Given all the challenges he's had in his life, he could have made it to the NFL, received his first big payday, and then said, "I made it. It's over, and I'm 23 years old." Instead, Michael Orr works out harder every day than most anybody I've ever met. When you really get it, what he is expressing is an absolute among true champions. There is no off-season. We are in this thing called life. We are in this company. We are in the Midland National Champions Club to get better every day. And if we are not in this to get better every day, someone is catching up. Some person, some team, some company is catching up. Michael Orr made the point in everything he did. Someone's catching up if you're not working at improving. And if we're not making that choice, if we're not out there sweating in that unbearable heat, rest assured that someone else is. The truly great ones get it. Granted, there are times when we need to take breaks or vacations, maybe from your work, but not your development. The truly great ones are always sharpening the saw. They are always in the habit of self-improvement. They make that lesson so plain and clear. I love Michael Orr. I love his lesson. But most importantly, I love his dedication to consistent improvement. Because I do believe that's an absolute when you study what makes the great ones great. Characteristic of greatness number 6. What off-season? Hey Champions Club members, I want to say thank you again for adding this audio series into your listening library. Putting these together for you each quarter has been an exciting process and one that I hope has been of great value to you as you tackle your daily lives personally and professionally. Should you want more? No problem. There are 16 characteristics of greatness. 8 have already been shared with you over the course of this past year. So that means there's another 8 lessons of the truly great that I can't wait to share with you going forward. If you'd like more greatness content even sooner, please go online and visit donyager.com. Thank you again for going on this study of what makes the great ones great with me. I challenge you now to go out, be great every day.
This is Jerry Blair, and I want to thank you again for making this quarterly audio series a valued part of your personal and professional development. We hope you've enjoyed these absolutes from Don Yeager in What Makes Great Ones Great as it relates to the 16 characteristics of greatness and lessons learned from true champions. I hope that you are inspired to continue unlocking your own greatness and turn your future from good to great. Once again, this is Jerry Blair. On behalf of Midland National Life Insurance Company, thank you for completing this audio series. I feel it's appropriate to coin a phrase from Don Yeager himself, "Be great every day." Thank you for listening.